After 1 year, when Durvasa Muni had returned, King Ambarish sumptuously fed him all varieties of pure food, and then he also ate, and then he himself also ate, rather than he ate himself, which wouldn't be good. When the king saw that the Brahmin Durvasa had been released from the great danger of being burned, he could understand that by the grace of the Lord, he himself was also powerful. But he did not take any credit for anything. Sorry, for everything had been done by the Lord. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. A devotee like Maharaj Ambarish is certainly always busy in many activities. Of course, this material world is full of dangers that one has to meet. But a devotee, because of his full dependence on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is never disturbed. The vivid example is Maharaj Ambarish. He was the emperor of the entire world and had many duties to perform. And in the course of these duties, there were many disturbances created by persons like Durvasa Muni. But the king tolerated everything patiently, depending fully on the mercy of the Lord. The Lord, however, is situated in everyone's heart, Sarvasya Chaham Hriti Santi Vishto, and he manages things as he desires. Thus, although Maharaj Ambarish was faced with many disturbances, the Lord, being merciful to him, managed things so nicely that in the end Durvasa Muni and Maharaj Ambarish became great friends and parted cordially on the basis of Bhakti Yoga. After all, Durvasa Muni was convinced of the power of Bhakti Yoga, although he himself was a great mystic yogi. Therefore, as stated by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 6:47, Yogi namapi sarvesham madgatanam taratmana shatavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. Of all yogis, he who always abides in me with great faith, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. Thus it is a fact that a devotee is the topmost yogi, as proved in the dealings of Maharaj Ambarish with Durvasa Muni. Amagena timarantasya genanjana shalakaya chakshur amlitam yena tasmai sri gurave nama shri chaitanya manobhistam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupakadamayam dadati svapadantikam. So it's a wonderful story about Ambarish and Durvasa. And the point that Prabhupada makes here, and it is made in the text as well. In the text, the point is Ambarish understood that Durvasa had inconvenienced him, and Krishna took it as an offense. And Maharaj Ambarish was the king of the world. He had a lot of work to do, and he didn't need the hassle. And Prabhupada says, as we go through our daily work, we get hassle, all kinds of hassle. And he says, from people like Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni wasn't a bad guy. He was a good guy. So we can get hassle from the good guys, from all kinds. We can feel like we're shot in the back. How dare that person say that? Here's me out serving Krishna all day and I'm treated like this and that. And so many inconveniences in life. And we don't really have any responsibility, not compared to Maharaj Ambarish. Here was a guy who had real work to do and real responsibility, and people depended on him. Hundreds and thousands of people. And not only people, but plants and animals and trees. He managed everything. And then he gets this chap coming in demanding this and that, and it's all a little bit too much. And it gets a bit difficult. And Prabhupada's point is, it's happening all the time. It's not just Durvasa Muni. This is, if you take on any responsibility in this world, this is going to happen. This is life. And Maharaj Ambarish, in the text it says, he realized because of this incident that he was powerful. But he didn't take any credit for it. Because as he saw it, everything was being done by the Lord. Now if you're the emperor of the world, well, you are powerful. I spoke with a correspondent for Newsweek one time. She was a She was a female, obviously. And I said, what was your... And she had interviewed everyone. Presidents of the United States, top rulers all over the world, everywhere she'd gone. I said, the interesting thing is, they're nearly all men, and as soon as they get power, they lord it over everyone. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, not one of them didn't make a pass at me. They just think they can have whatever they like. Because she's a female reporter, they give her a try as well. And you don't think like that about powerful people, but when you get power, people become a little bit full of themselves. You know, I can do this, I can do this, I can have this, I can have what I want. People are telling you that. They're all coming and fawning and bowing down before you and, you know, telling you in so many ways that you have power. And through this incident, it's interesting that it's stated here, Maharaj Ambarish, he saw that he was powerful. Why did he see it? Well, because of the incident that happened. Durvasa annoyed him in a way. He didn't take the offense, but Vishnu took the offense on his behalf and chased Durvasa all over the universe until Durvasa said, stop, stop, okay, I'm really sorry, please, what do I have to do? Go back and say you're sorry to Ambarish. And he had to go back to Ambarish, I'm sorry. And Ambarish realized, wow, that's... Because Durvasa's a big guy. He's not a small fish. You know, he's a big chap. And for him to come and bow down, for any Brahmin to bow down in front of a manager like Ambarish, even though Ambarish is the king of the world, a Brahmin doesn't have to bow down in front of anyone. The politics of the Brahminical culture is anarchy. They don't have anyone managing them. They just do their thing. And they're trusted to do their thing well. Durvasa stepped out of line. And he wasn't doing it well. He was actually annoying the emperor for no good reason. And the emperor in this case, even though so many emperors, including Indra, famous for being slightly puffed up, why? Well, as Prabhupada said, at least he's got something to be puffed up about. And we have to understand that he had actual power. But Ambarish isn't puffed up. It's very telling that it's said here that he wasn't puffed up, but he did realize his power. And that's very, you know, we think humility is someone who doesn't realize how good they are. You know, they don't realize how great they are. In actual fact, in this case, Maharaj Ambarish did realize how powerful he was. It's important for us to understand that how humility actually works. Arjuna on the battlefield, his humility was to fight a battle. It's not our normal idea of humility. You know, when we think of humility, we think of someone walking around being a bit obsequious and saying, oh yes, oh, thank you. Hit me again. Well, Arjuna wasn't doing that. Arjuna was hitting everybody else. And his job was to kill people. And to do that, you have to be angry. You have to be fired up. You got to be in the game. There's no messing around. Someone comes in front of you with a weapon, they're dead. End of story. There's no discussion about it. You've gone past all that. So, you know, it's just, you have to get fired up, and someone attacks you or threatens you or looks badly at you, you just take them out. So that's anger. It's not considered humility, but actually it was an act of humility because he wasn't doing it for himself. He was doing it for Krishna. He had to realize his power to fight. Otherwise, you can't stand in front of someone and fight if you don't feel you're capable. Or if you're just kind of sitting there twiddling a flower in your fingers going, whoa. It's not quite the mood. Maharaj Ambarish knew what job he had to do. He knew who he was in that job. He knew his power. He knew how to wield that power. And he took no credit, because everything in his consciousness had been done by the Lord. So it says in the purport, Prabhupada expands on that. So let's take that to another level. A devotee, because of his full dependence on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is never disturbed. So the king tolerated everything, even though there were many disturbances, patiently depending fully on the mercy of the Lord. That's very difficult to do. So one thing is to understand your power, and then the other thing is to understand how dependent we are. If we understand our power and then to understand our dependence, that seems like a contradiction in terms. How can we be powerful and dependent? It's just powerful means supreme, one of these people that this Newsweek reporter interviewed. You know, when you've got power, I've got it, it's mine. Wield it. So we take ownership. But Ambarish didn't take ownership of it. He didn't consider it to be his. This was a gift from the Lord. And that's the consciousness of a devotee. So Prabhupada brings out another point in the purport that's important for us to consider. Not only was he conscious of his power, and he didn't take credit for it, but he was also conscious of his dependence on Krishna. And he patiently, whatever happened, he just took it patiently, depending on the mercy of the Lord, knowing that the Lord would sort it out ultimately. Not that he didn't have to do what he had to do. And it's interesting how Ambarish acted throughout this whole occurrence. He never stepped outside the norms of social behavior. So Durvasa was a Brahmin. Brahmins are to be respected and facilitated. So that's what he did. He didn't do anything else, even though he wasn't being dealt with reasonably. And he had the power to come down on him like a ton of bricks. And he had the power even to point him out as someone who wasn't doing his job. But what would that achieve? That would give everyone license to point at every Brahmin and start complaining. It would start to mess around with the whole idea of authority in society. And that's very easy to do. It's very easy to point at someone and just start laughing or saying, yeah, I don't like your face. I don't like the way you're treating me. I don't feel good. And we can undermine authority. Undermining authority is not good for society. It doesn't help at all. We need authority. There's a Bengali saying that Prabhupada used, quote, that when the donkey goes through the washing lines and some copins, saffron copins from a sannyasi get cut up in his neck and he comes out the other side, people offer respect to the saffron. The fact that it's a donkey, that's okay. Because some people wearing the saffron also are rather donkey-like. But you still offer respect. Prabhupada says you offer respect to a Mayavad sannyasi. He said they have realization. You have to offer respect. You can't not be offering respect to sannyasis. You stop offering respect to one, you'll offer none to everyone. So we create this kind of seamless society where there's no, everyone's equal. That's just not true. Everyone isn't equal. All men are created equal is the American Constitutional Declaration. It's not actually true. We're not actually created equal, because if we all stand up, some people are taller and some people are shorter. Some people are fat and some people are thin. Some people are intelligent and some people are stupid. It's just the way it is. We know that. Why are we in illusion about it? We can't create physical or emotional or intellectual equality artificially. That's kind of eugenics. That's what the Nazis tried to do. They tried to take the impurities out of society and they identified impurities, Jews, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, gypsies. Let's just put them all in camps and just get rid of them. Purify the species. A biological purification, very limited, very silly. And it's the same philosophy, that we have some idea that we're created equal. We're not created equal. It's just not a fact. The only equality is on the level of Atma, on the spiritual level. We're all equally servants of Krishna. Krishna loves us equally. He doesn't love one better than the other. It's not that one devotee's service is better than the other. That's just bogus. Prabhupada says that's neophyte mentality. Krishna loves the heart with which the service is done. And it can be a pathetic service. And really most of our service is pathetic. And this is what Maharaj Ambarish was understanding. He may be the emperor of the world. What does that mean? Then there's the king of the heavens, Indra. Well, he's 1,000 times bigger than Ambarish. So many worlds, so many emperors. He saw the bigger picture, which is always humbling. And he understood himself as a servant of Krishna. That's his position. That's who he is. And he's not all these other things. So he takes on a service What's your service today? What's your service this life? Oh, it's to be the emperor of the world. Oh, that's interesting. Last life I was a milkmaid. But it doesn't mean that the milkmaid service or the emperor of the world service is any different in spiritual terms. In material terms, completely different. Milkmaid is absolutely insignificant. Emperor of the world, big guy, powerful guy, status, wealth, prestige of all kinds. Completely different materially, different karma. But spiritually, if they turn to Krishna, there's no difference. The only level in which equality exists. And this is what Ambarish is seeing. And if we can understand this simple point, the difference between material and spiritual, then we can begin to understand what it means to depend on Krishna. Because materially, there's no reason to depend on Krishna. Materially, everything's working by karma. We're going to get what we're going to get, so enjoy it, have fun. As we drive past someone in our Rolls Royce with our hand out the window, and we can lord it over them, we can do all these things. Who's stopping us? But we understand that it's temporary. Karma comes to an end. So why invest in that if we have a higher context, which is the spiritual? So from the spiritual perspective, Ambarish understands, I am an eternal servant of Krishna. That's my identity. That's where Ambarish is getting his self-confidence from. Not from the fact that he's the emperor of the world, which can give you tremendous self-confidence, because everyone is telling you, we're with you, you have all these armies, you have all this, all these secretaries, you have all this money and wealth, you have all these people at your command, what is your order? You are the greatest, you are fantastic, you are powerful. Everyone's telling you all these things. But Maharaj Ambarish is not bewildered by this. He knows that that's not who he is. I'm an eternal servant of Krishna. I'm here to serve. That's my job. That's the only reality. And in that reality, then he could treat Durvasa as he did. He could understand Durvasa in the scheme of things, in the scheme of society. His job as an emperor was to maintain society and maintain the stability of society. So he maintained Durvasa's position, which was very humble of him, when he could have attacked him and crushed him like a little bug. But he didn't do that. He took the humble position because he had a bigger picture. And we often, as devotees, we consider that we're not the body. And we preach like that. You're not the body. And you're not this and you're not that and you're not this and you're not that. But we have to understand that's a negative understanding. You can't meditate on that and get anywhere good. That's not the positive realization. The positive meditation is, I am an eternal servant of Krishna. We can do something with that. We can serve Krishna with that. To meditate that I'm not the body is just telling us what we're not. You're not the body, so you shouldn't enjoy material things, so you have to give up this and this and this, and you have to give up this and this and this, and that just leads to depression. And compression and repression and depression and suppression and just gets into cycles of not good thinking, negativity. How we preach becomes negative. We become judgmental about people. We look at them for all the things that they're doing wrong, not who they actually are. We are eternal servants of Krishna. You're not that body in this lifetime, and you're not that body in the other lifetime, and that's whatever. We can't do anything with that information except become depressed. What we have to understand is the message is we are eternal servants of Krishna. That's who we are. Confirmed. Thank you very much. And we can serve with that. We can get on with it. We can say, okay, what can we do now? I'm an eternal servant of Krishna. Now I can serve. Now I can understand that whatever I'm doing, I don't have to change that. I just have to do it for Krishna. So Maharaj Ambarish did his service for Krishna, and he did it wonderfully. And we're still talking about him. It was so wonderfully done. And he understood that even though he was so powerful, everything is Krishna. Why does he? Because he's a servant of Krishna. That's how he sees it. That's his practice. That's his sadhana. That's his meditation. because he understood, I am an eternal servant of Krishna, so everything that happens is in relation to Krishna. It's the only way we can have a positive spiritual meditation. The only way we can practice actual spiritual life. It's not negating the material thing. It's not renouncing. Because when we understand we're eternal servants of Krishna, this idea of ownership, that I am the emperor of the world, that is who I am, that is me, I own it, I own this land, I own this money, I own this power. Don't come and challenge me, because I will defeat you. I am powerful. That consciousness means that you have something to renounce, but you don't. None of us have anything to renounce, because we don't own anything. We're eternal servants of Krishna. We own nothing. Krishna owns everything. In simple Upanishad text, Isvasyamidam sarvam, yat kincha jagat cham jagat. Everything animate and inanimate in the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. We accept what's set aside as our quota and ignore everything else, knowing well to whom it belongs. Everything belongs to Krishna. So we don't have ownership of anything. Our land, the land we live in, you know, we're English, or I'm Irish, as some of you are Indian, and we die, and then that land is still there, and someone else comes and takes ownership. We collect stuff during our life, nice suits or dresses and a house, and we collect a partner and children and a job and titles, and I become Lord bloody bloody blah of bloody bloody blah. And then at death, it all goes, and someone else gets the title, and someone else gets it. Someone goes into the charity shop and buys the suit, and then it's theirs. All your furniture gets sold, and someone else says, oh, this lovely piece. This is Victorian, I think. Lovely. Mine.
Precious.
It's interesting, the word in the fifth chapter of the Gita, the word for attachment is lipyate, which means to get stuck. You get stuck on this thing is mine. You can't give it up then. It's like hand sticks to your face. Oh, can't get rid of it. So some idea sticks in your head. Some attachment sticks to our consciousness. We have to have. So Ambarish isn't, and any devotee isn't fazed by that. That's not an issue for them. They're not concerned about, you know, this service, that service, or losing this, or losing that, or having to hang on to these things. Because we're servants of Krishna. It means we're eternal. We're not bound by death. Death is going to come. You face it. It's not an issue. You take it head on. You understand it's going to come to all of us. It's going to come to our husbands. It's going to come to our wives. It's going to come to our children. Going to come to our grandchildren. It's come to everyone before us. How are we going to deal with it? We're going to deal with it as eternal servants of Krishna. So when the next opportunity comes, someone's passing away, you wish them well in their next service. You pray to Krishna to take care of them, that they can serve in a nice situation, because that's what we're going to do. We've elected to serve Krishna. So Krishna will engage us in service. So we look forward to the next service, whatever it is. We don't know what it is, but as long as it's service, good. We're in a good situation. If we meditate that we are eternal servants of Krishna, we take our service seriously. It's the most serious thing in our life. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur called it service concern. There should be no one as concerned about your service as you. That was his point. We have to take that and understand that it's not that someone just tells us what to do and we do it. We should take that thing and do it to the absolute best of our ability. We should engage other people in helping, making it really wonderful, really first class. We should use our intelligence to think of all the best ways we could do it and bring it as an offering. Engage ourselves 100%. Engage our emotions in it. Feel about it. Make sure that we're physically engaged. That we're there on time. We're doing it this way. We're doing it that way. That engaging ourselves in Krishna's service. Whatever it is. Maybe you're a mother. That's a service. Bringing up children. I mean, it's the You know, as sadhanas go, it's one of the most effective preaching engagements that ISKCON has had, procreation of children. We don't talk about it much because the process is just, but the actual fact is, you know, all these kids that come and chant kirtan, where did they get this love for kirtan? And some of them do all kinds of other crazy stuff, but they have this love for kirtan. That's a love for Krishna. It's affection, it's something from the heart. They're born with it. That's quite incredible. To bring up children is a huge service. You have to be so conscious of what you're doing to bring that child up properly, to protect them, to nurture them, nurture their Krishna consciousness. You have a few years to help them understand Krishna before the material energy just piles in. A few years where you can protect your child and nurture them and give them the impressions that will come out when they need it. Because the impressions made on us when we're young children, they're the things when things get rotten, they're the things that we fall back on. So you give a child a start like that, what a service to do. One pujari, I think it was Arundhati, she doing puja for many years, and then she had a child, and she wrote to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, I'm having great difficulty going on the altar with the child, because, you know, when you have a child, the child decides to have a poo or vomit or something at the most inopportune times, and you've just had a shower, and you've your altar clean, and you put on your sari, and you go to go on the altar, and your child decides to have a wee all over you. You know, so it's inconvenient. Prabhupada wrote back and said he couldn't understand what she was doing on the altar. He said, your child is your deity now. We don't think like that. That's just common sense, by the way. This isn't big theology. It's just common sense. If you have a child, that child becomes the center. You have to take care of that child. Forget everything else. That is your service to Krishna. To nurture someone to be a servant of Krishna, that's why we preach. So a lot of what we're doing is service. It's first-class service. Just do it in that consciousness that I am a servant of Krishna. I will do this with all my heart. All my heart and more. I'll get some heart from Krishna as well. So Maharaj Ambarish was managing the world like that, in that consciousness. Because if we think we are a servant of Krishna, we change the context completely. The context is not material anymore, and therefore the disturbances of the material world aren't as significant, because the material world is not the significant issue. If the issue is, I am the emperor of the world, that's who I am, then everything is about maintaining that consciousness, maintaining that position, maintaining that prestige and that reputation. If I'm an eternal servant of Krishna, that doesn't matter. I just do my service to the best of my ability, and Krishna makes up the difference. I do my best, but there's a bigger context. I'm not dependent on the results, because the results don't come from me. And this is what Maharaj Ambarish understood. This is why he didn't take credit, because he understood the results weren't up to him. They were up to Krishna. All he was being asked to do was to do his service to the best of his ability. And if we're thinking of results, that's something that didn't happen yet. If we're meditating on the results that I'm going to become a sannyasi, or I'm going to get married, and all these kind of things, and we're looking for, we have some epitome in our head of the thing that's going to be, and we're attached to that in some way, that means that our capacity to do service now is diminished. Because we're meditating on something that we're giving energy to something that hasn't happened yet. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't, but right in front of us now is the opportunity to serve. If we're competing for some position, we're standing on people's heads. We're thinking in a completely different way. And we're not meditating on the moment we have to serve, which is now. This is the precious moment that Krishna has given us. And now, how can I make this moment the best? How can I do this service to the absolute best? How can I decorate it with flowers? How can I make it most tasteful for Krishna? So that if Krishna came into the room now, he would look at this and he'd go, this is beautiful. Thank you very much. Everything we do should be done in that consciousness, not in some idea of what is going to benefit us in the future, or that I'm going to go to Vaikuntha, or I'm going to go to Goloka Vrindavan. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. We'll do what Krishna wants us to do because we're internal servants of Krishna. We won't do what we want to do. We'll do what Krishna wants us to do because that's what we sign up for. That's what we practice, and it is a practice. So this is challenging when we hear it as starkly as that, but it means we have to practice it from now. Maybe we've been practicing all our life to some degree. Great. It means when something difficult happens in our life that we'll understand this is Krishna and we'll accept it as Krishna's mercy without a second thought. And when I say difficult, life gets very difficult. There's so many difficulties. And ultimately death is going to be thrown at us in so many ways. And we're going to have to practice for that. And we're going to get difficult situations, and every situation we're given is an opportunity to practice. I can give you an example. Some years ago, I had to go to a hospital for an operation. It was the operation was to take 1 hour, less than an hour. I walk in, 1 hour in operation, and then walk out in the afternoon. That's the idea, right? So it was a week before Jamastami. I was reading the Krishna book in preparation for Jamastami, get my head straight, and I read this wonderful passage, very like this actually, where it said that any difficulty in the life of a devotee accepts it as a gift from Krishna, whether it be happiness or distress, pain or pleasure, fame or infamy. And I thought, well, that's a lovely verse. And I realized that's how our acharyas meditate. That's their practice. They meditate that any difficulty is a gift. I said, what a wonderful thought. So, and I realized that they see it as a gift from Krishna and they don't accept other explanations. And there are so many explanations for things that happen. We can say evolution is the explanation, or, you know, this guy over there, it's his fault, or something like that. We can attribute praise and blame all over the place, but we don't. We give it all to Krishna. And whether it's happiness or distress, whatever it is, it's from Krishna. So even if it's distress, even if it's pain, even if it's infamy, maybe you're a big swami and some kerfuffle happens and you lose your reputation, you accept it from Krishna. So Durvasa, you know, he had a bit of a fall from grace, and he took it as Krishna and he patched it all up. These things are going to happen in life. How do we deal with it? It defines us as a devotee. So this is... I was meditating on this, and I thought, I'm going in for a little operation, and I hate needles and things like that, so it's going to be a little bit of pain, so it's a gift from Krishna. I'll meditate on that. So this was my vow, my little vrata for the day, and then Krishna had another plan. It all started to go wrong when they gave me a general anesthetic, and in 35 years, I hadn't even taken a paracetamol, right? So my body was just virgin territory. It had no drugs in it whatsoever. So they gave enough anesthetic for 1 hour. I woke up 7 hours later. Right? Just zonk. And I didn't know where I was or who I was or what was going on. And then they told me, they gave me a completely different operation. Right? Once they got inside, it wasn't a simple thing anymore. It was a bigger thing. So I was like, oh, God. Next morning, they sent me home. 24 hours later, I was back in hospital. In agony, absolute agony. I never felt anything like it in my life. Now, this was all a gift from Krishna, remember. Right? It was only going to be an hour, but Krishna had another plan. And this just went on for 2.5 weeks, and 3 operations later, them trying to figure out what's wrong with me. Right? And during it, the nurses were treating me, I was in and out of hospital like a yo-yo, the nurses were treating me like I was just a sissy. I just couldn't deal with a bit of pain. You know, it's just a simple operation. What's wrong with you? And they used to just pass me by the bed and look at me like that, which didn't make me feel any better. Right? I took it all as Krishna's mercy. And it was getting more and more and more difficult every day. And I say, and then at the end, they did an operation and they found out that the first guy who gave the operation was a junior doctor, and he put some staples inside me to do something, and he left them in. And they were working their way down my innards, which was painful. So, you know, anyway, they took them out. Tremendous relief. Krishna, Krishna. Now, through this whole thing, after the second operation, when they tried to explore and see what was wrong and missed the staples, the anesthetist, they come out generally after an operation and they offer you morphine, you know, if you're in pain or something like that. And because of me and the drug thing, I wasn't conscious. Even when I was becoming conscious, I wasn't really conscious. So I didn't remember any of this. But the anesthetist came to my bed and said, "You said something to me when you were, you know, I offered you some pain relief when you were coming out of your operation, and you looked at me and you said, 'It's all Krishna's mercy.'" What do you mean by that? And I was just fixed in this, that this is a gift from Krishna. This is Krishna's mercy. And throughout this pain, I knew I'd taken this vrata that was only supposed to last an hour, and it was just lasting and lasting and lasting. And it was such an experience that, you know, what was the explanation of the whole thing? Krishna's mercy. He was so merciful. So merciful to put me through that experience. Now you may say, "That's not mercy, that's torture. He's a cruel God." But no, it's mercy, because someday I'm going to die. And it's not going to be nice. And I'm not going to be prepared for it. And it might be very painful. And I'm going to have to be able to turn to Krishna. I'm going to have had the experience of turning to Krishna and accepting Krishna in the most adverse situation and seeing Krishna's mercy, his kindness. So that was one thing. Another thing that came out of it was the second time I went to hospital. When you get sick, you kind of lie down and just wait for a nurse, right? Wait to be served. The second time I was in hospital, I was lying there and I was in pain and everything. And I just started to scan the ward and I looked at every bed. There was a guy on the bed beside me, and he was an old man. He had terminal cancer, and he was in agony all the time. And every now and then he'd just go, "Ugh." And he was so kind to the nurses and everyone around him, 10 times more pain than I was in. There's a young kid, about 17 years old, across the bed from me with cystic fibrosis. He was in and out of the hospital since the age of 3. Everyone in the hospital knew him. He was like a member of the family. And he was so jolly. He was going to be dead by the time he was 20. Just a jolly little chap. Wasn't an issue. Everyone in the ward was worse than me. I was a sissy. So I got up out of bed and I went around to see what service I could do. There's no circumstance where we're not a servant of Krishna. It just brought me back to who I was. I'm not a sick victim. I'm a servant of Krishna. So in this circumstance, there's service that I can do. And then every time I was back, I start looking for service. Doesn't matter that I'm in pain. It's not the issue. That's a bodily concern. My concern, my service concern, is that there's service for me to do. And am I available to serve Krishna now, in this circumstance? And when the time of death comes, what will my service be? Maybe it's to make other people feel okay. Maybe someone else is very distressed, or someone's going to be very distressed with my passing. How do I make it that it's okay for them? How do we think like that at the time of death? We will have had to have practiced it. We'll have had to have thought about it. This is the practice of Krishna consciousness, that Krishna is part of everything. And when some difficult situation comes, it's Krishna. When some good situation comes, it's Krishna. We always see Krishna in the good. Thank you, Lord. But when the bad thing comes, it's like, oh, it's karma. It's not karma, it's Krishna. Karma is not thinking in Krishna consciousness. Karma is a material phenomenon. It's just how the material world works. It's not a spiritual phenomena. Reincarnation is not a spiritual phenomena. We're not interested in it. We're interested in Krishna. The explanation for a devotee is Krishna. And you may say, well, I'm not a devotee like that. How can I think like that? It's because we think like that that we're devotees. This is the practice of a devotee. This is how a devotee thinks. And how do we start thinking like that? From today, from now. We just start thinking like that. Just make it like that. And the test came for me in the hospital scenario when the nurse came and told me the result of the final operation, which meant that it was their fault. They had caused me 2.5 weeks of pain. Some junior doctor, and then they had another doctor did a thing and didn't find it. Just makes it worse. And it just goes on and on and on for 2.5 weeks. It's ridiculous. Totally their fault. But my vrata was, it was Krishna's gift. The explanation wasn't that it was their fault. They were just agents of Krishna's gift. I had to thank them, not sue them. Suing them creates a society none of us want to live in. We're not interested in such things. We're not interested in money. We're interested in Krishna. Now, I don't know how much I could have got out of that. But I don't care, because it's Krishna. So when the surgeon came around with his team, he was a Muslim chap, and there was about 7 of them, and they're all around the bed, and the surgeon was at the end of the bed, and he was going, I'm very sorry. And I said, look, it's okay. There's no issues. Don't worry about anything. You've got a job to do, and it's a difficult job, and you're trying to help people, and you're well-motivated. You know, good on you. But I'm not going to do anything about this, because this was of great benefit to me. And he looked at me. I said, I'd like to thank you for the part you played, because I take it as God's mercy. This was a very valuable learning experience for me. And he just looked at me. Just didn't know how to compute. But maybe that was the most effective preaching I did that whole year, quite frankly. To be detached like that. Not detached for any other reason than Krishna. Everyone knew I was a Krishna devotee by the end of the 2.5 weeks. Apart from the fact that, you know, every time I woke up at operations, I was chanting Hare Krishna. And on Jamastami day, I was in hospital after an operation. I was totally out of it the whole day. And I woke up at 12 midnight on the dot, looked at my watch, 12 midnight, and went, Krishna. Krishna was very kind. So this is the kind of, and that's just, you know, my example is nothing compared to Ambarish or any great devotee. We all have to just start practicing. That's just one incident of the many incidences I didn't take to practice this. I'm just so glad I have one that I can share. But let's all find one that we can share. Some difficulty that's a real difficulty, and find Krishna in it. Immediately our thought is, where is Krishna? Why? Because Krishna is kind. So no matter what's going on, Krishna's kindness is here. I don't see it like that. I see it as his fault or her fault or some other situation or the weather or I hate you or something. But actually, if we just strive to find Krishna, there's some difficulty in some personal relationship, some devotee's making it difficult for us, our mother, our children, whatever it is. See Krishna in it. Find Krishna in our lives. He's in our lives every day. He's everywhere. We just have to find him. We just have to look for him. If we're not looking for him, we're not going to find him. So anyway, there are some thoughts. Krishna, Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Hari Hari. What time do we end? 5 minutes, okay. So if anyone has 5 minutes worth of question...